It's 5:30. I'm Nora Flaherty, and you're listening to MPB and Radio. Ahead on Main Things Considered this evening, we'll hear from some Portland renters on their landlord issues. And FBI agents investigate the embezzlement of nearly $4 million from a Camden-based charity. Those stories and your Maine newscast just after this NPR News. Let's have this look now at Maine news. Maine Democrats are concerned about what they say are possible ballot irregularities in the race for a southern Maine state Senate seat. Democrats have raised questions about 21 so-called phantom ballots cast for Republican Kathleen Manchester that were discovered in Long Island during last week's recount. Unofficial results showed Democrat Catherine Breen beating Manchester by 32 votes. Recount results showed Manchester winning by 11. Maine Democratic Party attorney Kate Knox wants the Secretary of State and the Maine Senate, which now has a GOP majority, to investigate the alleged discrepancies. Secretary of State Matthew Dunlap says his agency no longer has authority over the matter and that it's now up to the Senate. Hundreds of Fairpoint workers in Vermont who've been on strike for weeks are getting unemployment benefits, but officials in Maine and New Hampshire have denied those requests. Vermont Department of Labor Commissioner Annie Noonan says her office has processed more than 250 unemployment claims for the striking workers. But Maine Department of Labor spokesperson Julie Rabinowitz says under Maine law, participants in a labor dispute who could potentially benefit from the outcome are not eligible for unemployment.
It doesn't mean that the striking workers cannot apply for unemployment, but the likelihood is that if they don't meet the specifications of the statute, then they would be denied benefits.
Fairpoint workers in Maine and New Hampshire have appealed. In addition, Fairpoint has appealed Vermont's decision. Rallies are planned this evening in both Portland and Bangor in the wake of last night's Missouri grand jury decision not to indict a police officer in last summer's killing of teen Michael Brown. And the Maine and New Hampshire Departments of Transportation have reached a formal construction agreement with the Chinbrough Corporation of Pittsfield for replacement of the Sarah Mildred Long Bridge, which connects Kittery and Portsmouth, New Hampshire. The price will be $158.5 million that will be shared equally by the two states. In weather, temperatures slowly falling overnight with lows in the upper 20s north, upper 30s south. Tomorrow, snow is coming from south to north, hitting Portland by early afternoon and covering all but the county by dusk. Heaviest in the evening and overnight, total accumulation, a dusting to 12 inches with the least far north and the most just north and west of Portland. Rough traveling tomorrow. This is MPBN. It's 25 minutes before 6. This is Maine Things Considered on MPBN Radio. I'm Nora Flaherty. Thanks for joining me this afternoon. This month's deadly fire in Portland that killed six people has focused attention on code violations and safety issues in the city's huge rental apartment market. With vacancy rates extremely low, more than half the city's residents are renters, and while many of them are probably happy with their landlords and their living conditions, many are not. Tom Porter has our story.
Tina lives in a subsidized two-bedroom apartment in Portland's Parkside District.
It's five rooms, two bedrooms. I live here with my daughter and her boyfriend and their baby.
During her 4.5 years here, Tina, who declined to give her last name, has had three landlords. I asked if she's had good relations with them.
No, it's pretty much been a battle getting anything fixed.
With all the landlords?
With all the landlords, yeah.
She says she's complained about inadequate heating and the fact that the front door won't close properly. But her biggest concern is about fire safety.
Now, this is our nice dark hallway. Mm-hmm. No, there was a smoke alarm there.
Tina walks through the apartment to the rear exit, the emergency escape route in case of a fire out front. There's no lighting and the smoke detector has been disconnected for several months, she explains, because a clothes dryer kept setting it off. She says the landlord did replace it twice, but it kept going off, so he disconnected it and covered it up. Tina says he's ignored repeated requests to fix the alarm and install lighting. She's frustrated, she says, because about 4 years ago, not long after she'd moved in, the smoke detector in question proved its worth when somebody set two fires in the hallway.
I woke up 2 o'clock in the morning. My son lived here. I woke up to my son knocking on my bedroom door as I woke up hearing the smoke alarm, and he's like, Mom, why is that doing that?
Thankfully, she says, occupants from all six units in the building evacuated safely, and no one was hurt.
But if that happened now, you could maybe not be woken up because there's
no smoke alarm out there, and it would probably catch quite a big fire before it alerted to anybody.
Tina pays $950 a month for her apartment, the same amount paid by young professionals Tom McMillan and Crystal Cron. They live in a one-bedroomed apartment in East Bayside. They only moved in September, but they're moving out at the end of the month. The reason? Frustration with the landlord.
So this is the heater. It's an old-style heater.
Heating is not included in the rent, Tom explains, and when they moved in, it wasn't working properly in the apartment. Crystal says this became a big problem when the weather got colder.
It was freezing. It was, like, unbearable. We considered staying elsewhere because it was just so cold. I mean, the windows aren't sealed very well, and the walls aren't insulated, so if the heat is not on, it's like an ice box.
Yeah, it's cold. And actually, at one point, she told us that we should turn on the oven and use the oven as a heater.
Yeah, she said, I'll pay for you, just use the heating, the oven as heating.
They declined to use the oven to stay warm out of concern for fire safety. Tom and Crystal called city code inspectors and say they were eventually informed that there was backup electrical heating. But Tom says this was still woefully inefficient. Another concern, they say, has been the numerous water disconnection notices they've received because the landlord has not paid the bill. Throughout their time in the building, they describe their landlord's attitude as unhelpful.
It wasn't just not positive, but it was almost like, you know, that we were causing problems, and, like, I don't know, it was just always bothersome to her.
It's stressful. I mean, it wears on, like, your mind, it wears on relationships.
Tom and Crystal are hoping for better luck with their next landlord. Another Portland renter we spoke to doesn't know who his landlord is. James lives on the second floor of a late 19th century brownstone in Portland's fashionable West End.
Hey, how you doing?
He and a roommate pay $1,200 a month for a two-bedroom apartment, which they've occupied for 18 months. The rent goes to a property management company, but James, who also declined to give his last name, says the property managers themselves have not been proactive.
We just noticed, like, things slipping fairly, and nobody was really fixing them.
The apartment is spacious and well-lit with wooden floors. James says he likes it here and doesn't want to leave. But he does want things fixed, most notably the 18-by-14-inch hole above the dining room that first appeared about 4 months ago and has been getting bigger since.
At some point, our entire dining room ceiling could, like, chunks of it could fall on your head, and that wouldn't be good.
James says this is the second hole in the ceiling. The first one appeared above the pantry about 9 months ago. On top of this, a third one is starting to appear in the bathroom. When it rains heavily, he says, water drips into the apartment from several places. They had a bat come in once, too. He says attempts to get the management company to fix the problem have been unsuccessful.
It's frustrating. Every week you come home and you're like, you look at this hole in your ceiling and you're like, I would like to get that fixed, and you feel powerless to do so.
As for smoke alarms, there's just one for the whole apartment, located outside James's bedroom. Portland's fire code was updated in 2010 to require smoke alarms in every bedroom. However, only properties built or renovated since then have to adhere to that. So, despite the fact that none of the three apartments visited for this story had any working smoke detectors in any of the bedrooms, all three were considered code compliant. And that, say tenants, does little to make them feel safer. For MPBN News, I'm Tom Porter.
Caroline Losneck helped report this story as well. FBI agents continued to conduct interviews and analyze financial records as part of a federal investigation into the alleged embezzlement of nearly $4 million from a Camden-based charity. Rusty Brace has admitted stealing the money over the course of his 17 years as president of United Midcoast Charities. Brace has not been arrested or charged, but liens have been placed on all of his properties and bank accounts, and Brace's lawyer says his client is a target of the federal probe. In Camden, where Brace was held in high esteem by the philanthropic and nonprofit communities, the case has left a trail of unanswered questions. Jay Field has this story.
A little over a year ago, Rusty Brace got some good news. The following summer, Brace and his organization, United Midcoast Charities, would be honored with another big donation at Cellar Door Winery's Pop the Cause Gala. It's one of the top annual fundraising parties for nonprofits on the Midcoast.
Rusty has been a leader in the Midcoast community, an incredible face and voice and passion behind nonprofits up in that area.
But Tina Dalton is Cellar Door's owner. In June, a few days before the party, Dalton appeared with Brace and other grant recipients on Love Maine Radio, a podcast produced by Maine Magazine. Brace, who was about to retire from UMCC, was asked what had inspired his work at the charity.
A lot of people don't wake up in the morning, put their feet on the floor, and say, I can't wait to go out and ask for money. I like to do that.
The charity, said Brace, raises $1 million every 30 months or so.
100% of all contributions are 100% distributed.
46% of the grants, Brace noted, go to organizations serving disadvantaged youth and children. 24% go to community groups, 18% to medical services, and 12% to educational organizations.
So we know where the money is going. We do a good job of communicating where that money is going.
Brace was revered in the region for his charitable work. The Camden Select Board honored him at its August meeting after he retired. Steve Crane, UMCC's new president, vowed to continue Brace's, quote, wonderful and dedicated work. In September, after a week on the job, Crane and the board began to explore UMCC's grants for 2014.
And we were just looking at the total amount of money, and it was maybe a little bit shy of what we needed or thought we were going to have. And so I ended up talking to one of our directors and also a very strong supporter of UMCC.
That board member told Crane that he'd recently given the charity a check for $35,000, but Crane wasn't able to find it in the donation log.
We talked about it some more, and it became apparent that he had given us over the last 6 months two other checks that were not in our donor base. So I asked him to send me a copy of the checks front and back.
The board member emailed Crane the checks. This was on a Sunday. On Monday, Crane and another board member, who served as UMCC's treasurer, got together to look at the checks.
We saw that the checks had been deposited in a bank that was not a UMCC bank.
They took the checks down to the bank, the first, and showed them to officials there.
The bank realized that something had gone wrong, and so they did some research and saw that other checks over the years had gone into that account that should not have gone into that account. So there was a certain moment there when you said, oh my God.
The deposits stretched back over 15 years. Crane and the treasurer called Rusty Brace and asked to meet with him.
He came in by himself. We sat down. We confronted him with the evidence, and he eventually confessed, and he said, yes, I did take that money. He didn't seem to have much, what's the word for being shame or whatever. He just confessed and got up and left the room.
Official actions followed. United Midcoast Charities filed a lawsuit seeking to recover the nearly $4 million Brace is accused of embezzling from the charity. A court placed liens on Brace's bank accounts and real estate holdings, and the FBI launched an investigation. On the Midcoast, meantime, where many thought they knew Rusty Brace, the case has left only questions. Did UMCC do everything it could to protect itself? How could Brace deposit checks made out to the charity into personal accounts? And were there warning signs about Rusty Brace that people missed? Tomorrow, we'll try to answer these questions as our reporting on the Brace case continues. For MPBN News, I'm Jay Field.
And it's 14 minutes before 6 o'clock. Time to check the weather forecast with meteorologist Paul Cousins. I feel like there might be a little snow coming. I don't know.
Following the three-day thaw with the record warmth today in Portland, temperatures will ever so slowly return to normal as skies partially clear overnight, upper 20s north to upper 30s south. Tomorrow is such a busy day for many, meteorological mayhem to add to the frenzy as the storm spools up off Cape Hatteras. Rain will overspread York County late in the morning, commencing as wet snow north and west of Portland by early afternoon, blanketing all but the county by dusk. Low 30s north, low 40s south. Travel late and into the night will be extremely challenging south of Millinocket, a dusting to 12 inches by morning, least far north, most just north and west of Portland. Considerable cloudiness will occupy Thanksgiving Day with a few flurries inland. Fridays linger over the mountains and far north Friday with partial clearing for the rest of the state. This is meteorologist Paul Cousins for the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.
And at 13 minutes before 6, that's Maine Things Considered for today. Thanks today to Keith Shortall, Patty White, Mal Leary, Ed Morin, and Susan Sharon. I'm Nora Flaherty.